TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Michael Parenti has written on empire, fascism, imperialism, the demise of U.S. democracy, globalism, and terrorism. His recent book, the first to be nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, explores the death of Julius Caesar. Who was Julius Caesar? A dictator or a populist? And who really was Brutus, who was among those who murdered him on the Ides of March? A young hero or a participant in a deep-seated conspiracy? This intriguing lecture by the noted author, speaker, activist, and scholar, Michael Parenti, provides surprising new insights and parallels to today that are both shocking and amusing. Here is Michael Parenti talking about the assassination of Julius Caesar.
I wrote this book about ancient history, and one of the things I discovered was that ancient history is not all that ancient, that it has a currency, it evokes all sorts of themes. Collingwood once wrote that historians always see history in terms of their own epoch and their own time. Now that has a very nice ring to it. That's sort of almost an axiom of historiography, that each age redefines the history according to its own needs. And it's kind of a good antidote to the simple objectivism of somebody like Ranke, for instance, von Ranke, who was considered a great historian, who said, history is facts. And where do you get these facts from? You get these facts from documents. And where do you get the documents from? You get the documents from the Prussian government. And no wonder the Prussian government treated him so handsomely, gave him a chair at the university. The Bavarian king, the Prussian king, they gave Ranke all sorts of money. He was a total reactionary, hostile to the German parliament, as weak as it was, and voted an honorary member of the American Historical Association about the second or third year of its existence. They put Ranke in as one of the great lights of history. So there is that view, and there are these people who are totally, what's the term, embedded in some interest or another, and they insist they're writing totally objective history. What I discovered in my research of the late Republic of the Roman Empire, which is roughly, say, 100 to 40 BC, what I discovered is that it just wasn't true. They don't all see this differently at all. They all see it exactly the same way. Augustine, whenever he opens his mouth about ancient Rome, about the Gracchi, sounds exactly like Cicero, and exactly like Cyril Robinson or Ronald Symes, to name modern day ones. They all say the same things about that troubled and incredible struggling period of ancient Rome. He sounds exactly like Gibbon. And the same with all the ancients. Plutarch, Dio Cassius, Appian, Suetonius, Tacitus. They all sound extremely the same. Then you look at the second string Roman historians. I thought maybe, for some reason, I thought, well, the lesser known ones, the small guys, maybe they'll get a little closer to a different perspective. No, Valerius Maximus, Valeius Periculus, Asconius Pedonius, they all have the same view about the reformers of the Roman Republic. They all pretty much have Cicero's view. Despite their differences in time, what really gets mind-blowing is when you read the modern historians. Almost all of them say the exact same things that the ancients did. So, despite the differences in language, despite the differences in epoch and culture and region and nationality, despite all those immense differences, they all sound exactly the same and take the exact same line because they all share the exact same class ideology. They all are gentlemen historians. Let me tell you what the issue is, what the problem is. What is the issue? This book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, is a why done it. It's not a who done it. We know who did it. I make that point because I was in London, I was at a conference talking about this book, and the first program they printed out said, who killed Julius Caesar? And I had to wire them and say, I mean, email them and say, could you please not say who we know? And then I thought, well, maybe we could, you know, say, oh, it wasn't Brutus and Cassius. It was a lone assassin on the grassy knoll with a bow and arrow by the name of Lee Harvis Oswaldus. I said, no, you know, we can't go that way. We know who killed him. It's why was he killed? That's the issue. Well, by the way, you know, book readings sometimes, I've been to some, the authors like to get up there and they take it quite literally and they read and they read and they read mercilessly sometimes, right? The fiction authors are, I think, among the worst. You know, I'll just read one chapter. You know how long a chapter can be? Well, having said that, I will read a few lines only. The question that informs this book is why did a coterie of Roman senators assassinate their fellow aristocrat and celebrated ruler, Julius Caesar? The prevailing opinion among historians, ancient and modern alike, is that the senatorial assassins were intent upon restoring republican liberties by doing away with a despotic usurper. That is the position taken by almost all these historians, ancient and modern alike. That is also the position of the assassins themselves. I present an alternative explanation. The Senate aristocrats killed Caesar because they perceived him to be a popular leader who threatened their privileged interests. By this view, the deed was more an act of treason than tyrannicide. One incident in a line of political murders dating back across the better part of a century, a dramatic manifestation of a long-standing struggle between opulent conservatives and popularly supported reformers. The Roman aristocracy remained forever inhospitable to Rome's democratic element. And Rome's democratic element was the people. That's another issue I'm going to deal with tonight, the way the Roman people have been portrayed again and again as the mob. I'll bet you there are a lot of people here who will say, I don't know a thing about ancient Rome. I don't know a thing about the late Republic. And I was one of those. I write in my introduction, like any good American intellectual, I got to the postdoctoral level without knowing three intelligent things about ancient Rome. But it's not true you don't know anything. When you say, I don't know anything, think about it. You do. You do. This culture leaves very little empty spaces. They fill it in with their garbage as quickly. We all knew something about ancient Rome, didn't we? We know they all had togas. We know they all talked like Laurence Olivier or Sir John Gielgud. We know they all went to the arena and did this, and you know, ha ha ha. And we know the Roman mob was just a mob wanting bread in circuses and screaming crazy and idiotically. So we do know. These are the things you fight against. So one of the great pleasures of history is not learning history, it's unlearning it. It's to unlearn what you thought you know. And you say, oh, you know, you get that, it's a very interesting feeling. Oh, wait a minute, that isn't what they have been feeding me. Well, isn't that interesting? And that makes it kind of even more interesting in a way. So Caesar wasn't killed because he was ambitious, as many historians say. Ambition was their common coin. These aristocrats knew ambition. they'd kill their own mothers to get a step ahead. They wouldn't be turned off. Oh, he's kind of pushy. Oh, he's kind of ambitious. He wasn't killed because he grabbed power and he took power. Power was, again, the coin of the realm, the currency. That's what they were all dealing in, was power. That didn't bother them. As Suetonius says, they hated him and they killed him because he failed to rise when a delegation of senators came to give him certain honors. Oh, give me a break. You kill the leader of the republic because he didn't get up from the chair? They were all caustic with each other. They all cut each other and gave jabs and sparred in the Senate. Very acerbic debates at times. Yeah, like in Oakland. He was killed because he used that power against their interests. He was killed because he began to infringe on the prerogatives of the aristocracy. He was killed because he canceled rent payments for an entire year. Do you know how much a landlord likes you when you cancel rent payments for an entire year? That doesn't win popular. And most of these aristocrats were landlords. They were slumlords. Cicero was a slumlord. Crassus was the richest man in Rome. Most of his money, well, he had estates, he had merchant trade and all that stuff, but most of his money came from buying up many of the slums. They hated him because he instituted debt cancellation. Suetonius reckons about 25% of the outstanding debt in all of Rome was canceled by Julius Caesar. 25%, one-fourth, that's a lot. You know how creditors feel when you cancel debts on them? They don't like that either. He canceled it because the rates, the interest rates among the creditor class in Rome, and the creditor class were the same as the rich equestrians, and the rich equestrians were very close, and the same as the aristocrats in the Senate. The aristocrats in the Senate had all the same investment interests as the other investor classes did. Housing, slumlords, land, trade, a few things like that. Interest rates were about 45% interest is what you paid on a loan. He also did, like the Gracchi before him, Tiberius Gracchus and Gaius Gracchus, who were both murdered by the aristocrats. Clodius was in a very interesting, came from a leading patrician family, the Claudius family. I, Claudius, you know, ancient patrician family, changed the spelling of his name to Clodius with an O to make it more in line with working class pronunciation. Interesting. Renounced his patrician status to become a plebeian. Got himself adopted by some rich plebeian friend of his so that he could qualify and run as a people's tribune. Which if you had patrician lineage, you could not be a people's tribune. You could still be a consul and all those other things, of course, like Caesar was. And organized, Clodius organized guilds and unions with proletariat, with slaves even. By the way, there were some Roman leaders who talked about freeing the slaves and having only free labor. There were a few, and there were a few who were moving in that direction. And that was an issue that was just beginning to come up in the Roman Empire. It was killed when Christianity came in because the Christians totally dampened that issue. No question. Absolutely, totally. Christianity was totally unsympathetic towards slavery. That's a myth about they were with the slaves and all that. They actually didn't like slaves joining the church and all that. You can read about that in History as Mystery, my other book. There was a long line of these popular reformers, all of them from aristocratic background, who were murdered because they supported these kind of reforms that Caesar himself was supporting. Another thing he supported was land redistribution. The Gracchi were the first to start open that issue again. For centuries, Rome had been victualled by the farmers, independent, small, poor farmers working the rich lands of the Campania region around Rome. Many of them in cooperatives, too. So here they fed Rome. Here were these markets. Here was this consumption. These human needs were being answered. Money was being made. And the land was publicly owned. It was the agar publicus. It was public land. And the farmers paid a modest rent to the public treasury. So you had revenue coming in. You had markets. You had human needs being taken care of. You had human consumption. You had production. And you had these aristocrats not making a penny on the whole thing. I mean, it just infuriated them that the people just taking care of themselves, you see, without us controlling it and extracting as much as we can. Well, in those 2 centuries of the Punic Wars, right up until early in the 2nd century BC, say maybe about 6 years before Gracchi, all that land was sooner or later expropriated from the poor farmers. They were driven off. Many of them had to serve in the infantry. In fact, the independent farmer was the great Roman infantry. And Rome's power as an army was its infantry, not its archers or its cavalry, which were rather inferior. Well, you know, you go away and you fight for 10 years, your farm can't be kept up. The rich aristocrats moved in there like the leeches that they are and took over, bought up these farms for pittance, and the ones who didn't want to sell, they brought their thugs in there and their strong-arm boys and beat them and drove them off the land, just as the rich corporations did in Appalachia against the farmers who were sitting on coal, or just as the rich railroad magnates did against farmers all across the Great Expanse who were in the way of their railroads and so forth. Drive them off with guns and clubs, kill them, and then you take the land. And that sort of thing happened. Well, what the Gracchi started was this struggle to redistribute, to give some of that land back. Now it became large latifundia, is the Latin word, which comes down to us through Spanish, latifundia, literally the large plantations, and they were being worked exclusively by slave labor. What happened to the farmers? They were driven into the towns. Does any of this sound familiar to you? Into the shanty towns in Rome, it wasn't shanty towns, it was tenement houses, 7, 8, 9 stories high, walk-ups, of course, no running water, no lighting, no sewage, typhoid, fires, the houses easily collapsed in many instances. So there was the move among the reformers was to redistribute some of that land. Caesar also did some other things. He argued that every rich landowner who had a slave labor force had to hire 1/3 of his force as free labor. This would create more jobs for the proletariat. That's what they would call the proletariat. That was their name. Marx got the name proletariat from ancient Rome. And it would also cut in on the profits of the very rich and give some of it back to the people. Another thing he did was impose luxury taxes and limits on how much wealth can be accumulated. The limits were very generous. So that's why they hated Julius Caesar. The same reason they hated the Gracchi and Clodius and Saturninus and a whole range of maybe 6, 7 other popular leaders from 133 BC to 44 BC. 133 is when Tiberius Gracchus was murdered. 44, Caesar was the last in a line of popular reform leaders. The evidence is overwhelming that this was what motivated them. Now, there's another axiom in historiography. It says, you must avoid the sin of presentism. It's a kind of contradiction of what Collingwood said about everybody sees history in terms of their own epic. This says just the opposite. You must not see history in terms of your epic. You must immerse yourself into the reality of the particular historical society you're studying. Immerse yourself into it, and you must see it as its own people saw it. Now that's beautiful. Who's going to say, no, I want to do it the other way? No, he's going to say, that's beautiful. Let's assume it could even be done. But what does it mean? What does it mean to avoid presentism? I'll tell you what it means when you see a society purely on its own terms. It means you see a slaveholding society on the terms of the slaveholders. Who do you think wrote those books and documents and parchments and letters that you have and that you're looking at? What does it mean to say, see a society only on its own terms, immerse yourself into its struggles, its feelings, its sentiments, its values and all that? Good. What does that mean if you're doing research, let's say, on Nazi Germany? What do you do? Say, oh, well, these Nazis are really, oh, I just feel like a Nazi today. And, oh, look, they're cleansing Europe. Isn't that, that's what they're doing. I mustn't pass any judgments on that now. I mustn't take a critical perspective. And are they hurting anybody here? Oh, I'm just injecting my own values if I raise that question. No, that's an empirical question. Your own values may lead you to that question, and that's very good. That's why you want to have historians who have democratic values. It leads them to certain kinds of questions that Mommsen and Gibbon and Augustine and Cicero never even think of asking. In fact, to look at a society only in its own terms means you're looking 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100 means you're looking at a society only in terms of its ruling class. That's what you're looking at. You are sharing the myths and rationales and lies and self-justifications that that class has about itself. And that is not the job of the historian. That's the job of a class propagandist, a ruling class propagandist. Arthur Kahn made this point. Contemporary American and British ancient historians are divided between Ciceronians, who are 95% of them, and Caesarians, a mere handful. And this is the interesting part. He says, and the division reflects their current political attitudes. That's Arthur Kahn, who himself is one of the handful of Caesarians. Well, Parenti, if all ancients and almost all modern historians have one interpretation about the motives of these aristocrats, how do you arrive at your conclusion? Did you unearth new evidence? No, I didn't unearth new evidence. I mean, 2,000 years, it's all been pretty much developed, but you can take old evidence and make new associations with it. You can read your enemies and read against the grain. Many of you are politically aware, politically active people. You get a good deal of your information from the mainstream media, from our enemies often. You can get it from the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle, or, I mean, you have to go to page 23, paragraph 18, and you find something there, and you realize the significance. You see how they decontextualize it, and you recontextualize it and put it in a context and suddenly see its links and its meaning. And that's what you do here. I'll give you an example. For instance, Suetonius's discovery that Caligula contemplated building an annex to the library in Alexandria. Well, that jumped out off the page at me. Because there's this long-standing debate, as to, not really debate, a one-sided presumption that Julius Caesar burned the great world-famous library in Alexandria when he was down there. Caesar loved libraries. He built public libraries in Rome. They were all shut down by the Christians when they came into power under Constantine, and all the books were burned then. The library in Alexandria was burned by a Christian mob. The books were, the building was left. When the Muslims came in, they were often also faulted. They did destroy what was left, but what they destroyed was a library that simply had a few patristic and papal studies, a few church writings, and Aristotle. So this is very interesting. I have a whole thing in the book there, I mean, a whole thing, a page and a half or so, showing how Caesar could not have burned the library. There's testimony of the library being in use years after Caesar. So here was this nice little datum from Suetonius. Now, I'm sure many people have read it, but I've never seen it used, and I was able to cite it and make that point. So that's how you could use old information in new ways. I'll give you another example. I found a letter by Cicero, and when I say I found a letter, I don't mean I unearthed this letter, you know, and I blew it off and found an original manuscript. It's a letter. All his letters are published. But I'll tell you, if many historians had read this letter, many also had ignored it. This is what the letter says. It was written right after Caesar was murdered. Mark Antony convinced the Senate that they had better keep Caesar's reforms. If you go to the Foro Romano today in Rome, you could see the Senate house is right, it's just about 100 meters up from the center of the Forum, where Caesar's body was, where there was a huge crowd, including some of his troops. And Mark Antony convinced them and said, you better keep his reforms intact. And a very nervous Senate said, yes, we won't act against the assassins, that's their concession to them, they're going to be even-handed, and we're going to keep Caesar's reforms. Well, when Cicero heard about this, he was absolutely furious. After killing Caesar, his reforms remain in place. Quote, is it not lamentable that we should be upholding the very things that made us hate Caesar? He makes my case. That's my case. It wasn't Caesar's power. It wasn't Caesar's personal attributes. It wasn't this or that or the other thing. Caesar was now dead. That isn't what they hated. It wasn't that he violated the Roman Constitution and the Republic, as they were constantly saying. It was that he made these reforms. And that kind of evidence, you see, is systematically ignored by the Ciceronian historians.
That was Michael Parenti, the author, activist, and popular public speaker on the assassination of Julius Caesar. You heard the first half of a one-hour talk. Next time, you will hear about the circumstances of the murder of Caesar. This rebroadcast is part of the very popular and ever-expanding series on what Parenti calls real history. That's a different and intriguing reading of a surprisingly large number of all too familiar stories. Parenti grew up in a conservative, Catholic, working-class Italian community in New York City. After receiving his PhD in political science from Yale, he risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD or a film on DVD of Michael Parenti's Assassination of Julius Caesar by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD or DVD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or a credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.